All right, get everybody up tonight. We're going to be looking at the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 7, 1 through 6, which I think some people have probably suggested that it used to be the case that John 3:16 was probably the most well-known passage in the Bible, but maybe that shifted a little bit to this passage because of our culture and what we think about judging and how we shouldn't make any evaluations about what's good or bad morally in the life of other people. So this has become a really famous passage for other reasons than John 3:16 maybe was. But before we start digging into the text itself, I just want to explain or show some other passages on the board here of what the Bible says in other places about judging. And then we'll work all of this into what we're looking at tonight. So here's just a couple passages to consider. 1 Corinthians 2:15, the spiritual person judges all things. 1 Corinthians 5:12, for what do I have to do with judging outsiders? Is it not those inside the church whom you are to judge? Or 1 John 4:1, beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God, for many false prophets have gone out into the world. You've got this idea of making judgments or evaluations there. John 7:24, do not judge by appearances, but judge with right judgment. And then, even in the context of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, beware of false prophets. They're going to come in with sheep's clothing, but inwardly they're ravenous wolves. You'll recognize them, or you'll be able to make an evaluation or a judgment about them based on their fruits. So you've got a lot of passages in the New Testament that say, in one way or another, that making evaluations or judgments about things is something that's actually required for the Christian. We have to do it the right way. And we'll talk about the meaning of the word judge in a little bit here. But these are some things that, as we look at this famous passage, ought to paint some of what we're looking at as we go through this. Any comments or questions just about this before we start reminding ourselves of some things from the Sermon on the Mount? All right. So just a couple things to say about the context of the Sermon on the Mount. Some of these things we've brought up before. But in the Gospel of Matthew, there's five times where you see the phrase, when he finished these sayings, or some kind of very similar sort of phrase. And again, remember that the Gospel of Matthew is painting Jesus as the prophet to be like Moses. Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible, and Matthew is making it very clear with this phrase that Jesus has five blocks of teaching. And to a Jewish audience, perhaps something that would have resonated with them. We've mentioned that as you read the Sermon on the Mount, if you're reading it with an open heart, nobody can really read the Sermon on the Mount and walk away saying to themselves that they're a good person. And so, in some ways, the Sermon on the Mount is the ethics of the kingdom, but it's a very high standard. And so one of the things that happens after the Sermon on the Mount is Jesus performs a series of, I think it's 9 miracles, where he heals people who are paralyzed, for example, spiritual paralysis. Do you feel like you're spiritually paralyzed after you read the Sermon on the Mount, that you can't do these things? Well, who's the one that gives us the power to be able to do it? Jesus does, and I think these miracles show that. All right, have you guys ever noticed how Matthew 5 through 9 then becomes kind of a section in the Gospel of Matthew? I want you to look at Matthew 9:35. This overall section in the Gospel of Matthew begins and it ends with a similar phrase. So in your Bibles, look at Matthew 9:35, and what I'm going to do in my Bible is I'm going to read 4:23. You see what I'm saying? So you follow along in 9:35, and I'm going to read chapter 4, verse 23. And it says, and he went throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction among the people. Was that really similar to what yours said in 9:35? Okay, that's just a really easy, quick way of showing that there's a similar verse that comes before the Sermon on the Mount and then right after the Sermon on the Mount. And this passage talks about Jesus' teaching, which we see in the Sermon on the Mount, and then his miracles, which we see right after the Sermon on the Mount. And so it's bookended by saying that these are the things that Jesus was doing. Now here's a section in the Gospel of Matthew that shows him doing those things. And I don't think we've brought that up before, so I thought at some point we've got to bring it up. So, anything you guys want to say about that stuff? Alright, let's then go to Matthew chapter 7. And one of the things that I've tried to think through a little bit with Matthew 7, is it seems like verses 1 through 12 sort of all function together in some ways. Right now we're just studying 1 through 6, but in your translations, what's the first word of the word of verse 12? My version is ESV and it says so. What other translations do you guys have?
Therefore.
Anybody have anything else? The idea is that verse 12 is somehow drawing a conclusion from the things that had been written right before that. And if you look at verse 12, so whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. Well, how does that draw a conclusion from what he talked about in verses 1 through 11? And here's my stab at this. In verses 1 through 6, what we're looking at tonight, we've got to be careful how we make judgments. And to be careful in how we make judgments, we have to be people who are asking, seeking, and knocking for the wisdom to know how to do that. And this is exactly what we want people to do for us. So perhaps this is one way that you could connect all of this. Otherwise, you might have to look at it as kind of a string of proverbs, where here's a little paragraph that has something, and then it's not completely connected to everything. But if you wanted to try to connect all of this, this might be the context of what we're looking at. There's probably arguments you can make either way for that. But anything anybody wants to add to that? All right. So, outline of what we're looking at tonight. Oh, let's start out with this question, then. What does it mean to judge? Because that's what we're looking at tonight.
Pass a sentence.
Okay, to pass a sentence on something in the sense of, like a final verdict. Okay, what else? Okay, good. To make some kind of a presumption about somebody or something that they did or whatever. If I was to tell you to think about the color blue, there's going to be a range of that color. Some of us might be thinking of a lighter shade of blue. Some of us might be thinking of a darker shade of blue. The common denominator is that it's all in the same ballpark of the color blue. There's when it comes to Greek words and English words, there's something that's called a lexical range, where that same word is going to have a ballpark meaning, but it can have a different shade of meaning. And so the word judge can mean to make an evaluation of something if it's good or bad. So you can say, okay, that's good, that's bad. What that person did is bad. You'll know them by their fruits. Like he says later, you're supposed to make an evaluation about that. The word judge can also mean a form of punishment or a form of condemnation, like when Jesus comes to judge the living and the dead. So that's where punishment or condemnation is going to be determined by Jesus. So when this text is telling us to not judge, which of those do you think it's referring to? Yeah, the idea of punishment or condemning. Of course we need to make evaluations about things. We're commanded to do that in this text, actually. But one of the things that we have to work through as we think about these things is, what's my motive in these evaluations that I'm making? Am I finding some kind of joy in finding fault with other people? Because I don't want to give out too much right now. But is my goal to punish people, or is my goal to actually help them in the evaluations that I'm making? And those are some of the things that we'll kind of walk through as we think about these things. Anything else you want to say about the idea of judgment or judging?
There has to be a standard.
Yeah.
I mean, you just can't arbitrarily pick anything. When I'm making a judgment, there's a standard somewhere for which I'm going to use that and going to base this judgment on.
Right.
It can't be, you know, and I know you're going to get this, it can't be mine.
Right.
Because if it's mine, then it's going to move and it's going to do all these other things. So, of course, we're going to talk about the Lord's, he's the standard.
That's right.
The standard.
Yeah, good. Anything else?
So you're probably going to get to this if verse 12 is kind of a bottom line summary, or maybe the thing to which all these things lead. And I think the second verse, 7:2, says, okay, think about how you would want to be evaluated.
That's right. And so you even see that in
kind of beginning and end of that, right? Or that whole section would be the same.
Right.
And I always say it this way, it's like the golden rule, but if I were in my right mind, how would I want somebody to treat me?
Right.
So maybe I'm off.
I think that's...
I'm off lost in sin. Well, I might think in that moment, I don't want you to condemn me, but if I were in my right mind, I would want you to come and judge and help.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And I think that's why when we look at verse 12, in the way that I read the Sermon on the Mount, at least this part of the Sermon on the Mount, I think these things all are connected in one way or another. The trickiest thing for me to figure out how it connects is the asking, seeking, and knocking part, because that seems to go back to the ideas of prayer that we talked about in chapter 6. But in the context, you can see, okay, this is really hard to know how to make the right kinds of judgments with the right kind of attitude and everything. So would it stand to reason in this context, part of what I'm asking, seeking, and knocking is the wisdom that I need to make the right kinds of judgments. That seems to fit the context, but however, I mean, either way, that would be true. So, all right, so the outline of what we're looking at tonight, verses 1 through 5, you could say is kind of talking about improper judgments. That's not a completely accurate characterization of this as we'll go through this. But then verse 6 is how to make proper judgments, and there's some overlap in how we're characterizing these things. But let's go ahead and start out with verses 1 through 5. Who wants to read that text for us?
Do not judge that you will not be judged. For in the way you judge, you will be judged, and by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye, but you do not notice the log that is in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, the log is in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye.
All right. Because of how this passage, I think, is used in our society, let me just start out with this question then. How have you heard people use this passage?
That if I've ever been guilty of anything that I'm about to talk to you about, I have no grounds to discuss this with you.
Okay.
Like if I've been a drunkard before, and I can't talk to you
right.
about that. If I've ever been guilty about any of these things, I can't address you.
Okay, good. Well, how else have you heard people use it?
Intolerance. Oh, I do know what James said, too. If you've ever been guilty of any sin, not even the one I'm looking at.
Yeah.
Right. If you have any imperfection, you talk too loud.
Right. Yeah. Anytime you make any kind of criticism about anything, that the Bible says you're not supposed to judge. And so that's
until you're perfect.
Until you're perfect, right. But then when Jesus does it, it's still offensive. So what were you going to say, Danny?
I was just going to say intolerance.
Yeah, okay. I want to point out then, what is the goal of this text? What is it that Jesus is wanting us to learn from this passage? And it's in the end of verse 5, I think. When he says at the end of verse 5, then you will see clearly to take the speck out. So what I would argue he's doing here is he's saying, all right, part of what kingdom living is supposed to be like is it's supposed to be a community of people that hold one another accountable and help one another, and this is actually how you do it. So it reminds me of Hebrews 3:13, exhort one another every day as long as it is called today, that none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. He's saying, all right, if you guys are going to be in community together, if this is going to be the new family that Jesus is creating in this kingdom that he's made, that part of what a family does is we hold one another accountable and we help one another. And this is the way that you do that. Let's think about this question then. What prevents us from being this kind of community? Why is it the case that sometimes we might be part of a local church for a long time or maybe a short time, and nobody ever seems to point out things in me that should be pointed out, or I'm not doing it for other people? What causes a community to not be like that?
First off, they're not really a community in the first place. You don't know the person to begin with, so how can you first off make that kind of correct assessment of seeing they're doing wrong if you don't even know them and what they do or how they behave and what drives them?
Okay, good. So if there's no genuine cultivation of relationships, that could be the end result of that. What else?
I think sometimes when we see that speck in our own eye and we think it's pretty huge, and who am I to come to you to point out your flaws? So there's a fear of addressing somebody.
Okay, yeah, so maybe we feel unqualified in one way or another, so we don't ever do it for other people, so that would be one reason. Any other reasons you guys
have? Fear of spoiling the relationship.
Yes.
When you are have a family and you are aware of things, that's kind of that's the necessary but not sufficient condition. Do you have the courage maybe, or maybe the love, or whatever it is that would get you over that fear or another fear of ruining the relationship?
Good. Sometimes the... Maybe the kind of relationship we have with people you know, it may not be the deepest of relationships, but you certainly wouldn't want to imagine yourself being an enemy of that person. And that would cause us to maybe not say something that we should or we could. I think part of our cultural context, I talked about this a couple weeks ago in the sermon about how Christianity fits our deepest needs, but the way that traditional societies would help you figure out your identity was by looking outside your society, and if your society said you had to do what your parents did for work, or you have to, you know, this is going to be the occupation you're going to have, you look at what the society is saying, and then you work your heart to fit that. But then in our society, we say that the way you find your identity is you determine for yourself what you want to do, and then you go out and you demand that people respect that. So if that's the sort of society we live in, the kind of relationships we've been trained to cultivate are the ones that are only affirming the things I want to do. And so part of what's expected of people in the kingdom is that our relationships are not just transactional, where I'm just getting the things that I want from you. Sometimes it means that we're going to be saying stuff to each other that we need to hear, but that doesn't fit the way that our culture thinks about relationships right now. So that maybe that's one reason for that too. Anything else you guys would say about this?
I think sometimes people would say, well, it's none of my business. Like, I think today when it was brought up, they'll say, well, I don't really want to, that's really not my place.
Yeah.
To go to that person.
Well, and for me, I sometimes think, well, somebody else has probably talked to that person.
Or knows them better.
Or knows them better, and so they're probably in a better position to be able to do something like that. Yeah. Joan?
Sometimes I think I have to come to terms with my own and the problems. I think when you realize that you fall and what God has done through somebody else or just on his own through his word, I think you gain the humility that opens you up to speak the truth and love.
Okay. Good. So you see, do we see in verse 5 that this is what Jesus is teaching? That we need to become a community that does help each other. So we can't just take the first couple of verses of this and say, well, we never talk to anybody. That's not the point of this. So let's start out then with the kind of judgments that he talks about. You could maybe characterize the sort of judging he talks about in two ways. First of all, I think verses 1 and 2 talk about this kind of person that's just hypercritical and kind of a fault finder sort of person. And maybe we could ask this question. What are some ways that we make these kind of sinful judgments about people where we're just hypercritical of everything everybody does? What are some ways that we might do that? And actually, that's kind of a hard question. So let me give you the first answer that I have anyways. When we don't leave room for conscience issues. When we don't understand that Romans 14 says that Christians can actually come from different cultural backgrounds and have different conclusions about certain things, not everything, by the way, but there's certain things that we could actually have a different view on. And when there's some Christians that might not understand that there are gray areas, and when they don't see those things, they might make judgments about people that don't see those issues eye to eye with them. So that would be one example of how that could happen. Were you going to say something, Danny?
Well, maybe in the case of the Pharisees, that they found fault with Jesus because it somehow diminished them, that by, you know, reducing his character, that they somehow could elevate themselves.
Okay, good. Good.
Cultural issues.
Yes.
Someone's culture might be different. They do things differently than, you know, somebody else.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I in 1 Corinthians 9, when Paul says he's become all things to all men, do you suppose that there would have been some Christians in the first century that would go to these different cities and not be interested in that because they want to push not just the gospel but also their culture on other people? They're making judgments about other people based on their culture, but it's not actually based on biblical things. So that would be making judgments based off of the wrong criteria to begin with. And so ethnocentric kind of ways that we would look at other cultures and not understand that maybe what they're doing is okay, but it's just not the American way, which is not always the biblical way. So can you guys think of any other examples of this?
This kind of ties in with that last one, I think, but I thought of 1 Corinthians 13, 4 through 7 saying bears all things, believes all things. Hypercritical, you know, I've been guilty of that. When you look at somebody, you just assume the worst.
Right.
You judge them that way. That's a sinful way to judge.
And I think the bearing all things fits into What about a new Christian? Yeah. You got a new Christian. Growing takes time. And so what if somebody's been a Christian for a couple months and you're making the assessment that they really should be further along? Maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong. But if you're not understanding that growth is a process, you could start getting into a hypercritical kind of way of judging. It doesn't mean we don't confront issues that need to be confronted. But what's our attitude in how we do that? Do we understand that it's taken me a while to get where I am, and that would be true about everybody else? Marty Reason.
Well, I think another, maybe see your list somewhere, this idea that we can determine a motive for an action.
Yes.
Sometimes something that's said, and really nothing wrong with it, but we can decide that person did it out of pride or out of desire for attention, or there was a hidden criticism in that, none of which on the surface is really true, but we presume that.
Right.
And I think that's especially common when we are struggling to forgive someone for something else in their life, and that we just assume that they've soiled their nest with regard to their Christianity,
right,
and nothing that they do then is genuine.
Okay, good.
I just think that's an example of how that's expressed.
Good. Anything else? I got one more. How about just nitpicking other people? And this might apply more to like romantic relationships, where you're just kind of like criticizing every little thing that somebody does because you've got this image of what you want that person to be in your life, which causes you to just nitpick everything because you just can't stand this loved one in your life to be this way or that way. So I'm just going to be hypercritical so I can fashion them in my own image. Which would be a way of trying to actually find fulfillment in a person and not in God. Doesn't mean you never have hard conversations, but I think that would be one example of how that could happen as well. Anything you guys want to add to that? All right, what happens then in verses 1 and 2 when we're doing things like this?
We can't see clearly.
Let's just start in verses 1 and 2. It's going to be measured back to us. So, what does that mean?
If I jump on everybody, for folks who are late to services for years and all of a sudden I show up late, I should expect the same kind of response.
Right. Or you see this with maybe professional athletes that maybe talk a little too much and boast a little too much about other players that aren't winning games and stuff like that. And then when they start losing, what do all the sports commentators start saying?
Play the tape.
Right. Right. And it's like, if you never would have been making all of these silly judgments, nobody would be throwing it back in your face. Nobody would do that. But because you've opened your mouth so much, we kind of feel compelled to do this to show you that you're not everything you think you are. And so... I think we're going to be judged in the same manner by other people, for sure. I think that'd be one application to that. He says if we're not being merciful to other people, we're not going to be shown mercy. He brings that up earlier in the Sermon on the Mount when he talks about prayer, that if we're not forgiving other people, we won't be forgiven. So I think we can see how this would apply to other people and how they would treat us back. But it also, I think, applies to maybe how God would judge us as well. Like, if you're going to be like this, how about I throw it back in your face and see how that works? Because, think about this question. With the way that you make judgments about other people and evaluations about other people, could other people make judgments based on the same kind of criteria that you're using against you? Do you live up to your own sense of standards? All right. So, that's just the first two verses here with, I think, the fault-finding mentality. He's going to get into hypocritical judgments in just a second. So I think you could almost say he moves from hypercritical judgments to hypocritical judgments. But anything else you guys want to say just about the first two verses here? All right. So then let's move to the hypocritical judgments in verses 3 and 4. Notice what Jesus asks in verse 3. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? All right. What is the answer to that question? It's a really good question. Why is it the case that it's really easy to notice the sins in other people, but not the sins in our own life? Why do we do that?
Because it's convenient, setting those double standards.
Okay. How else? What else?
What's good for you is not necessary for anyone else, or for at least for yourself, or that kind of mentality.
Okay.
Pride.
Pride? Okay, yeah, pride would do that. Any other reasons why we do this? Because I think this is something that all of us have experienced before. Mm-hmm. It's easier to see faults in other people than in ourselves. So what motivates it? What was that?
Painful.
It's painful to look at your own problems, but it may be, you could say it this way, it improves your self-esteem to find problems with other people. Isn't this Luke 18? When you've got the Pharisee and the tax collector that go up to the temple to pray? The parable begins by saying that Jesus is preaching this to people who trust in themselves that they're righteous. So, if you were to talk to these people that Jesus was preaching to, and they were sitting down with a psychologist, and the psychologist would make the evaluation, well, this guy's got really high self-esteem, which in our society would say, well, that's great. Okay, why does he have high self-esteem in the parable?
Because he's comparing himself to this other.
Right, because I can find problems in other people, and it makes me feel pretty good. And so I think one of the reasons why we see problems with other people, but not in ourselves, is because we want to feel good about ourselves. And this is one method that people use to feel good about themselves. Nanette?
I find that when I look in the mirror, I see one a certain face. You know, oh, I really, I get all dressed and I think, oh, this looks great. But you take a picture or somebody has a picture of you and it looks a lot different to me. I don't look the same in that picture as I do when I'm looking at myself in the mirror.
Right.
And I think that, you know, we don't see ourselves.
Yes.
In what the way other people see us, or that we truly are, maybe.
And I think that goes to another point. We have blind spots that we can't see, and that this is where we need, like when you're driving in the car and you're trying to see if you can move over into another lane, sometimes you have to ask other people in the car that might see the blind spots that you can't see. This is one of the reasons we need one another. It's because we can point these things out to each other. Yeah, Cornelius?
Also, I think it's easier to hold somebody else accountable for their failures or their lack thereof than it is to actually hold yourself accountable.
Right.
Because now you have to face all those negative aspects of yourself, but it's easier just to point the finger at the next person.
Right. Because if I have to start pointing the finger at myself, that means I actually have to overcome this. But if I can just command other people to do it, then the responsibility is on them. So maybe it makes us feel like we've done something productive, but not really hard. Danny?
Well, I mean, just like Cornelius was saying, when we look at ourselves and our own faults, we can put it in its proper context because we can see and rationalize why we're the way we are. Maybe we can even justify
sure.
some of our faults mm-hmm. and imperfections because we see, maybe we do see it more clearly, where when we look at another individual, we don't know what's all in their heart. We
right.
don't know what lies underneath that external presentation they're giving to us.
Right.
And that's where we make our bad judgments.
Right. We tend to justify things for us because, after all, my mom and dad were this way towards me or because of this, that, or the other thing. But we don't consider those things for other people. And so, yeah, that's a good point. The picture that Jesus gives here, imagine somebody with this 2x4 or maybe like a 2x6 or 2x8 sticking out of their eye. And they're trying to help somebody that's just got like a little bit of sawdust, and obviously they're going to end up doing more damage than good. You see that the picture here is that when you've got sin lodged in you, it actually makes it so your self-understanding has been distorted. You can't even understand yourself super well when you've got a 2x4 sticking out of your own eye. And you can't really be able to see clearly to help the other person. So the solution then becomes what? What's the answer to be able to actually have the community that God wants us to have?
It's what's in your own eye.
Right. You have to remove the log that's in your own eye. And then it's only after you've done that that you're actually able to be able to start helping other people more effectively. Now, why is that the case? Why is it the case that when I let's use what's a sin that is common in our society?
Fornication.
Okay, let's say fornication. Let's say that somebody used to do that and then they didn't do it anymore. How come when they have stopped doing that, what makes them more capable of being able to help people than the person that's continuing to do that? What do you guys think? Okay, so maybe you have more empathy because you've overcome it. You remember what it was like to be there. What else?
Maybe you can't teach someone
know how to read a book, you don't know how to read that book yourself.
Right.
Or like you can't climb a mountain without doing that. Or you can't teach someone how to climb a mountain if you haven't done it.
Right. All right. So if the only thing that if I'm continuing a certain sin that I'm trying to coach somebody else out of, the only thing I really know how to do is yell at them. But if I've actually worked through it myself, I can say, yeah, I remember when I ran into that specific struggle in trying to overcome this, and this is really what helped me in that scenario or whatever. You know how to coach somebody through it in great detail rather than just saying, well, you should stop doing that. And so I think going to Steve's point, when you have overcome it, you're able to be more gentle. Remember Galatians 6:1, if anyone's caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual, and in the context of Galatians, who are the ones that are spiritual? They have the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, all the, and you start singing the song. You should restore him in a spirit of gentleness, and then you keep watching yourself lest you too be tempted. When you overcome it, you have the ability to, I think, you at least have the resources to be more gentle, rather than just yelling at people in that way. Anything else you guys want to say about that?
Well, I think when you go back to the Sermon on the Mount at the beginning, when you go back to the having being merciful and all the other things, when you still have that spirit and you still realize how God's forgiven you and how He's amputated you, you still have that same spirit of what Jesus was talking about earlier, then that helps you to handle the situation with others. And just like you said earlier, how was I forgiven? How was I treated? How would I want to be treated?
Right. Good. And we've already talked about this a little bit, but you can explain the process of how all this works. And so just going back to the same ideas, we need one another to help us grow. So we're not making hypercritical judgments. We're using God's standards. So in churches, by the way, sometimes Christians make judgments about other parents or other families based on non-scriptural things, like, you guys don't vaccinate, or you guys do vaccinate, or you guys homeschool, or you public school. Like, things like this that God hasn't really explicitly spoken on, that we can start making hypercritical judgments about. We've got to be using God's standards, and we have to examine ourselves. And as we do that, we realize that we're not perfect, which changes our mindset and our motivations in going towards somebody. All right, so those are the improper judgments and sort of how to make the right ones. Then we move to the proper judgments. So I think verse 6 sort of balances out everything that we've been talking about tonight. I'll just go ahead and read verse 6. Do not give dogs what is holy, and do not throw your pearls before pigs, lest they trample them underfoot and turn to attack you. All right, so let's start out with this question. What is the pearl? What was that?
God's word.
Yeah, I think you can make an argument that it's the gospel message. There's one other parable or a little story in the Gospel of Matthew that uses the pearl, and it's the shortest parable in the Bible. But in Matthew 13, again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls who, in finding one pearl of great value, went and sold all that he had and bought it. And when we look at what's the pearl there? Well, it's talking about the treasures of the gospel message and everything like that, and the kingdom that you get to be part of. So maybe the pearl is the gospel message. And that fits the context of Matthew later on. In the immediate context, what else could the pearl be?
Proper judgment.
Hasn't he just talked about, like, okay, if you are able to remove the log from your own eye, and then you can actually take the speck out of somebody else's eye, isn't that kind of advice a pearl for some people to come to you and say, look, I've worked through this in my life. It doesn't mean I'm perfect and everything like that. But this is something that I think would be really helpful for you. That's a pearl. That's going to help you change your life. So in the context, I think it could be either of these things. I think both of them would certainly be true. And so the next question then is, who are the dogs and the pigs?
The ones that you've given this information to, and they've now rejected it and actually become hostile towards
right.
it.
Right.
Which is what normally we've talked about there. People are one of the reasons why people don't. Even if they have the greatest intentions to help, that fear of someone turning into a dog or a hog prevents people from sometimes even trying to give judgment.
Right. Now, if you were to go to General Mir and get one of their cheesecakes, which is one of the, it's the best cheesecake. And then you got like a cheesecake from like some cheap cheesecake, and you had a dog in front of you. Would the dog care about the difference in the quality? They're not going to notice anything like that. So what dogs and pigs are okay with is just scraps. That's good enough for them. What they're interested in is just feeding their immediate appetites. So that means that they can't see the value in the things that you're trying to give them. They're concerned with, well, I've got this need right now. I need to know how to connect in my workplace so I can advance and everything like that. Is the gospel going to help with that? Is this advice that you're giving me right now, is that going to help me financially? Because those are the things that I'm interested in. And so when you see that the gospel is not actually going to do all of these kinds of things, then they start trampling it over, and they're not very concerned about those things. So here's Jesus' instruction. Don't keep throwing the pearl before swine. Because they're going to trample over it, cover it up with mud, and then they're going to turn and attack you. I think one of the things that we're seeing with all of this is, okay, we've just learned, how do you make proper judgments? Okay, you got to remove the log and everything like that and make sure that your attitude's in the right place. All right, now you're ready to go help people, right? Okay, well, not everybody's going to want that. And so what he's saying here is that you shouldn't just keep trying to cram it down somebody's throat if they don't want to hear it. There are times where Jesus would walk away from people that didn't want to hear from him. The apostles would do the same thing. And so I think one thing that this passage is showing us is that sometimes the reasons that we get attacked as Christians is because of the way that we keep trying to force feed somebody that doesn't want to hear it. And then we might walk away and go, well, I was persecuted for righteousness' sake. And maybe the case is you were persecuted because you didn't have discernment. Do you see that in this text anyways, he's saying, don't throw the pearl before swine, and if you keep doing it, they will attack you. So you can't walk away from every time you felt persecuted and think, well, this is so righteous that this happened to me. No, sometimes it's because you weren't using the right discernment. But on the other hand, this doesn't mean that we shouldn't be preaching the gospel. We're still supposed to do that. So this isn't an excuse to not do that. Any comments or questions about that? I've been saying too much probably right now. Let me say something else about this then. Have you ever seen this happen where somebody, maybe there's like a love interest in their life or somebody that they're dating or something like that, and then suddenly that person seems to get concerned about evangelism and learning how to teach one person. And then maybe that person eventually gets taught, or maybe that person keeps kind of rejecting, like, well, what's the thing that I need to say that's finally going to get to them? Because they're kind of making fun of these things and they're not believing it and everything, and they're just very fixated on teaching this one person. And then maybe that person gets converted and then they stop getting concerned about evangelism or something. But I think sometimes we can have these people in my life, my parents or my kids or my brother, like, these people have got to get taught, and these are the only people that I want to teach. Jesus is saying that if people are not appreciating this message, that you actually need to stop, because you're going to do more harm than good in that case. All right, so let's ask this question then. How do we know when we should walk away?
When the other party walks away.
Okay. What else? Because this is a hard command. This is not a suggestion that Jesus gives. This is actually a command. That there are times that you do need to walk away. No matter how much you might really love those people, no matter how close you might be to them in every other kind of way, there are times where you need to stop.
They just rejected you.
Okay. How would we know if they have? Because there might be some Bible studies that you have with somebody where, like, you sit down and study with them and you're like, yeah, I just don't think that's true. And then you go, okay, well, do you want to study again? Yeah, I think so. Okay, so do you? Yeah. But they didn't believe everything you taught them in that study. So how do you know, how do you make these discernments?
I've told people, when you tell me to stop, when you right. actually tell me to stop, then I'll stop.
Right.
I mean, really, just when it stops. I mean, if someone keeps about, like, you can tell. This, is this something you want? Is it just my company,
right,
that you want, or is this? But if you stop, you don't. I said, you don't have to do this. I tell people, right. You're an adult. I'm not trying to force this.
You're not going to hurt my feelings.
You're not going to hurt my feelings. If this is not what you wanted this time, it's okay to let me know.
Right. Yeah, Danny?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a factual doubt where somebody's just given the truth. You know, they understand it. They respond well. Maybe it's emotional doubt where there's just some deep-seated pain underlying why they're not willing to commit. And you have to work through that. I don't know if those two even apply to this, but I'm wondering if it's maybe more this idea of volitional doubt.
Sure.
Where
they just don't want to do what it
says.
The facts
don't
right.
matter.
Right.
And I think that can become quite obvious.
Right. Well, and so getting back, when you think about this idea of dogs and pigs, in the Gospels, what are one of the reasons people were seeking after Jesus? For food? And for another miracle and stuff like that? Jesus wouldn't do it for them. People that are interested in studying because maybe you'll give them a handout and maybe you're kind of hoping, okay, well, I'll do a couple studies and maybe the gospel message will start to sink in and stuff. But if it's not changing, they're concerned about fleshly appetites and you've got to walk away. Steve?
Not only that, he wouldn't even explain the parables to them.
That's right. Yeah, he's not going to... What was it? One of the rulers wanted this Jesus to do some fireworks for him and do a miracle and he didn't in the Gospel of Luke. So he's not going to entertain people in those kinds of ways. So, anything else you guys would say about this?
I was just thinking about talking about Jesus. You know, when he would have hard sayings to individuals and they stayed.
Yeah.
You're like, and he would say, I haven't seen this with my own people.
Mm-hmm.
You would think, you know, they were most of the time they were Gentiles. When someone hard something, and even though it may be hard, but they're willing to keep digging. And go up and he's like, okay, that's a person that seems to be concerned and interested.
Right.
But that, you know, they'll let you know pretty early that this is not something they're too much interested in.
Right. Well, one scary thing in this, what if I developed the reputation where every time somebody's tried to give me godly advice, word gets around, oh yeah, when you try to talk to Eric about something, he just gets really upset. Do you want that kind of reputation? Because that means that you're actually blocking out people from loving you. So the way that we respond to the pearls of people who have been through things that need to say things to us that would help us, do not develop the reputation of the kind of person that doesn't receive that. Because then nobody's going to help you anymore. Because in those cases, the Bible is commanding people, stop talking to that person. Don't be that person. Were you going to say something?
So how do you know when someone is genuinely not interested versus you're just passing judgment?
I think this goes back to what James was saying. If they tell you they're not interested, or if they tell you, like, I think a nice tact is to say to somebody, like, hey, I've noticed some things, may be helpful, I might be not seeing things exactly right. Would you, like, is it okay if I say something to you about whatever? And if they say no, then don't do it. If they say, well, yeah, what is it? Or whatever. Or if I'm studying the Bible, somebody, if this isn't interesting to you or if this isn't stuff that you're really wanting to keep doing, you can just tell me that. I think if you let them tell you, you don't have to get to the point where they're starting to trample you over. Jesus is actually trying to say, don't get to that point where they start attacking you like a pig. There's a way you need to try to discern that before that happens. That's not always going to be the case. Paul would preach in different cities and they would start attacking him and then you'd say, okay, I'm done. But when they would start doing that and making fun of it, he would walk away. Steve?
There's a real fine line in dealing with people who aren't Christians because right as you're about to realize your condition and what you need to do, you become defensive. And
yeah.
That could be confused as rejecting.
Right. Right. And I think sometimes if somebody does get defensive, it's like, well, at least I know that they heard what I said, and maybe when the dust settles, they'll have thought about that, and we'll have a good follow-up conversation and stuff like that. So yeah, it's not like a one-time experience, and then you write the person off or whatever. But, all right, anything else you guys want to say about any of this? Do you see how the Sermon on the Mount is dealing with a lot of things that are not measurable in scientific kinds of ways? It's dealing with things that really focus on our hearts, which sometimes religious people want to focus on the measurable things so we can feel like we get the check marks. The Sermon on the Mount doesn't let us do that. It forces us to actually analyze what's in our heart. So it's been good studying this. I think we have two more classes. Two more. Okay, so we'll finish this out in the next couple weeks.